Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, February 17th. Hope you had a restful President's Holiday if you had the day off, and we wish you a happy Lunar New Year, which we mark today. This morning, we hear from Hawaii Mayor Kimo Alameda. He just gave his second State of the County address. We also check in with the Mauna Kea Management Authority. The hard work begins on the mountain's future. And we survey democracy in South Korea. A gathering at the Institute for Korean Studies brings academics together to provide points of view of its future. And we also talk about an arms manufacturing plan here in the Pacific. And we turn our attention to Vi, an art exhibit around water that unites us across the globe. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Big Island Mayor Kimo Alameda gave his State of the County address last week and talked about the priority of housing. It was a chance to look back at his first year in office and check on his progress on the issues he campaigned on. Alameda talked with us this morning about his priorities going forward.
We have a mayor's package that we all submitted. And for Hawaii Island, you know, I got the other mayors to agree on legislation around the cesspool conversion, the cost for each resident to make that happen. And, it was basically, legislation around tax credits or some kind of loan program or something where, it's not costing each resident up to $30,000 just to, move from their cesspool to a septic system. And that was my pitch at that time. And, we'll see how it goes.
Well, that is key for folks who already own homes, right? It's just to be in compliance with federal law, because we are, I think, the last state where we were still allowing new construction, without, falling in line with the EPA guidelines. But, you talked about how housing is a priority, affordable housing for your community.
Sure. I mean, I did talk about affordable housing, but, like I said in my State of the County address, it's super complex. The greatest tragedy to the affordable housing crisis is homelessness. And unless we figure this out, we'll see homelessness grow. And so what I shared is that, it's going to be a partnership, because if you look at the cost of a home, it's a bunch of things. Let's just start with building codes. The more regulated we become, We're pricing people out of a home, right, for safety reasons. But, hey, nothing's more unsafe than being homeless, right? So we need to really look at what regulation does to people, over-regulation, if you will. And then there's roads. A home is not a home if it's not connected. And what connects us is roads. But roads can be expensive, too. I mean, let's face it, if you want to purchase land in an area where there's nice paved roads, it's going to cost you. So what happens on the Big Island is people choose areas in where the roads are all, gravel roads.
Mm-hmm. Substandard.
Busted up. Yeah, substandard. But, hey, that's where it's cheapest. So they end up moving there, and then they look to the county to fix their road. So, it's private roads. And then there's electricity costs. There's wastewater costs, like we just talked about. There's water costs even, right? So on our island, there's some places on the island that, there's the reservoirs and, the aquifers and all. We need to work with the state to construct wells so that we could develop. But that's going to play into affordability as well. Then there's home insurance, right? Lava Zone 1, Lava Zone 2. In those areas, just home insurance alone will not make a house affordable. And then there's interest rates, the federal government, right? People don't realize that affordability crosses every single sector, federal, state and county. And so if interest rates are at 10-12%, nobody has cash for a home.
Yeah, the down payment.
Cost you,
yeah,
right?
It's a killer.
And then there's property taxes. I finally got to the place where, after a year of being in office, I realized the complexity in affordability. And nobody's able to talk about it like I have. So people have come up to me and they said, wow, you've cracked the code. I mean, you understand it like nobody else. And I do, because, you know, I'm an academic. I like to dig deep into problem solving. And I find that this is a big one to tackle. And it's going to require all agencies, all hands on deck, if we're really to make a difference.
Well, that said, you know, I know that the building codes, at least here in Honolulu, haven't been upgraded, you know, and it's probably statewide, actually. But, you know, we're just lagging behind, you know, same with the cesspools, right? I mean, we've had these federal mandates and, you know, we just can't keep kicking the can down the road.
Well, that's true, but we don't even know what we're kicking. So, like, I want the cesspool conversion mandates, septics, that's not even the best technology. Yet we're forcing people, you know, to utilize a septic system. Like in the shoreline areas, I have homeowners who come to me and say, Kimo, who's going to reimburse me? Because our septic system, which we just put in, it's not working. We flush the toilet and it goes straight into the ocean. So what we're telling the legislature, first of all, is before you make these mandates, you know, it'd be nice to have some funding attached to it. But more importantly, you got to get the science straight. You know, and so that's what we're doing now. So another proposed legislation is to allow for different technologies. Septic might not be the best, especially in shoreline areas. Maybe it's a low-level pressure system, you know, some alternatives, which is the Department of Health has to kind of help us better understand. And so yeah, I mean, we're kicking the can down the road, but we don't even know what we're kicking. That's a big concern as well.
Well, you know, I know that Hawaii County was leading the way, you know, when it was taking a hard look at the building permit process, right? You folks, I think, started that before anybody else.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, everybody's in different stages, right, on trying to build more inventory for our people, more housing, and we're all looking at it, you know, doing things differently based on the county's needs.
Sure. We've done an excellent job at that. You know, I have an acronym. It's called BREW HIPS, you know, and every letter stands for something. So one of the P's is permits, right? The faster we can get permits out, that'll also save costs at the end of the day. So that's one task force that I've disbanded because we've solved that problem. I mean, in fact, we're getting permits out so fast, you know, contractors jokingly tell us to slow down because now they cannot blame the county anymore for, you know, like the narrative was, oh, you know, they would tell the homeowners, oh, you know, we're waiting for the county permits, but that's not true anymore. So now the homeowners are like holding them accountable. So that's how I know things are going really well on the permit side. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, county, we're trying to do everything we can on our side to put more houses out there because it's a supply and demand issue. We get that. But I also share with people that you know, you can't just put people into a house. Some of these homeless folks, they're homeless because of their mental health issues and their addiction issues. You just give them a house without support, they're going to be homeless because they can't hold a job. So this is where we need support services, those wrap services, those nonprofits. This is where they come into the picture in helping us to solve this homeless situation.
Well, gosh, you know, I know that, you know, we're in the middle of kind of an aspect of bad weather. You know, how's the county holding up just, you know, with all the wind, the rain, and the snow on Mauna Kea?
Yeah. I know. Well, you know, Hawaii Island has been super resilient. I mean, especially on the east side, we can handle rain. The west side, we pay particular attention because, you know, that's tend to be the drier side. And the main thing for us is ensuring that our culverts and our canals are free from debris. And so in this recent, semi-flash flood, if you recall, that was the first thing that we addressed. And there were three or four culverts just piled up foliage, you know, and if we didn't get there in time to clear it up, you know, that's where flash floods could occur, right? Because then water got to be diverted in places where it shouldn't. And then it becomes a safety issue. So far we've been managing pretty good along the lines of these hurricane type flash floods, high winds. You know, we've been through a lot this past year when it comes to those types of disasters and, you know, storm systems.
How are things along Banyan Drive? You know, because I worried about those large trees. You know, given we had that terrible, you know, incident with the tree falling over and those two fatalities of the women there. But yeah, I know that, you know, the plans are to redevelop, you know, that area. But so far, so good.
Yeah, thanks for asking. You know, so far, so good. So you're right. I mean, that shocked us. I mean, that banyan tree fell for no reason. I'm sure there's a lot of reasons, but for us, it's just like out of the blue, right? So that made us take a harder look at all of the banyan trees, especially on Banyan Drive, since there's over 40 of them. And we identified one that is potentially an issue. And so we are actually chopping it down as we speak. And we've been at it for 2 weeks now, and it's these banyan trees. I didn't realize how invasive they are. So they start off as like one stem or one trunk, and then it ends up like 100 trunks. And it's just so hard to cut down. But, you know, slowly by slowly, it's coming down. And once we clear that up, it's not just safer for the community. It's just going to add more light into Banyan Drive. So when you take that cruise through, it doesn't feel so dark. And so we have a lot of ideas now on how to improve Banyan Drive while we're taking down that big banyan tree that starts off the scenic route, if you will.
Well, yeah, it just with the winds, it's just been crazy over here. And that was the first thing I thought of was, gosh, I wonder how those trees are faring with the high winds. But gosh, you know, I know that you had mentioned that, you know, you were here with the mayors pitching before the state lawmakers about your needs. You know, any sense as to, you know, those hearings and how far they'll go?
Yeah, I think we're doing pretty good in terms of our needs here because, you know, even if, you know, our tax credit, cesspool conversion bill, I don't think it made it through. There are some other legislation like a loan program or utilizing green fees that can help offset the cost of the cesspool conversion. So I think that's good. For us, it's also Banyan Drive is going to be up for testimony this week, I believe, which is good because, you know, we want to propose moving it to another agency that could work with the counties better, I think.
Yes, the Hawaii Development Authority. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're hoping that passes. Then we can move along our study of Banyan Drive and get to the point where we could really develop it to the place where how it was, right? We want to make it better. And so I'm looking forward to that legislation as well.
Okay. All right. Anything else that you want to get out to our listeners this morning?
Well, let's let the listeners know that, you know, Big Island is a great place to visit. And so it's also an awesome place to live. And, you know, we're doing the best we can to make it an enjoyable place, a safe place. The county does have a lot at stake when it comes to beaches, you know, gyms, parks, fields, roads. And we work really well with the state. So I think we're doing a pretty good job. We had a great year, and we just want to kind of continue that momentum. So, you know, if you're ever on the Big Island, and for those who live on the Big Island, just thank you so much for your patience. And some of these projects take longer than expected, but, you know, nevertheless, we are moving forward,
okay.
And that's a good thing.
One step at a time. But thank you so much, yes. Mayor.
You bet. Have a good day.
And that was Big Island Mayor Kimo Alameda, who we spoke with this morning.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
Join Hawaii Public Radio as we continue honoring Mahina Olelo Hawaii. As part of Live from the Atherton, we welcome Kamaka Kehau Fernandez performing live at the Atherton Studio on Saturday, February 21st. Live from the Atherton is sponsored by HMSA. Tickets are now on sale at hprtickets.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
The Mauna Kea Stewardship and Oversight Authority is set to assume control over the controversial summit in 2 years. Construction on the planned 30-meter telescope stalled since the 2019 protest, and the National Science Foundation recommended funding for a different large telescope project in Chile, creating a funding shortfall of about $1 billion for TMT. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Blaise Lovell is out with a story on the authority board this morning. He joins us now. Good morning, Blaise.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so the authority's been busy, going around getting input from people about, what this authority is going to look like.
Yeah, so lawmakers created this authority back in 2022 after the protests that halted TMT the last go around. The idea is, to let the community really drive what happens on Mauna Kea from here on out. That was one of the criticisms of the state's past management. So, in the last couple of years, they brought on a few staff members. They're looking for some new office space. But right now, the big task is what you just described. You're going out to various communities, not just on the Big Island, but also on Oahu, Kauai, the entire state. And, they're trying to ask them what they want to see on Mauna Kea, how they want to see visitor access managed, what they hope to see on top of the mountain, and how they want to see things going forward.
Yeah, and the University of Hawaii had that responsibility for managing the Mauna, and then there was all that pushback with this really large telescope.
Yes, it did, and UH has done a lot better. In the last few years, they set up the Center for Mauna Kea Stewardship, and that's been managing things. But in the past, and there were a series of audits some 30 years ago that found chemical spills on the mountain, UH not doing enough to oversee the observatories. People who would go up to visit, saw trash blowing around on the summit. And that's a sacred site, and that, kind of irritated a lot of people. And even though UH is doing better now, that still kind of, engendered a lot of public distrust in the management, and that was another thing that kind of led to where we are today.
Yes, and John DeVries is, at the is writing point on this authority, and he's really trying to listen to what the community has to say.
Yeah, he is. That was a point that all of the authority members I talked to reiterated. They don't want to have to go fast. They're going to be on time. They're going to complete all their planning on time, but they don't want to rush things. And they also don't want to appear like they're favoring one sector. And that's been one of the tensions here. The observatory leases, they expire in 2033. And that means that normally you would start getting the preliminary studies for those done now, things like environmental impact surveys and such. But the authority, they want to make sure the community comes first. John Komeji reiterated that in a letter to UH officials last year. He said that they want to work at the speed of trust was the phrase that they used. And that is something they say is going to, take time to build that community trust. And it's going to take, actually being out there in the community and doing all of these meetings.
And then your article talks about how it may not meet the deadline, though, for new rules and regs that it's trying to set up. So how does that all work?
Yeah, so they've got this bill in the legislature that would keep UH's rules in place for the time being until the authority can finish its rulemaking process. Now, administrative rules, they can take many months, sometimes years. There's lots of rounds of public hearings like they're doing. They'll need to do more to set up those rules. And, those things are like, here are the times the summit is open. Here's where you can park your car. It kind of lays out like, the really basic rules. But the broader management plan and the strategy and what the community wants to see, all those things they're going to have done by the 2028 deadline. It's just those rules might take a little bit more time because they're focusing on, that comprehensive management plan they're trying to get done.
And, they have been trying to speed up the decommissioning of the telescopes, right, that were supposed to go away. And so, what else can you tell us about that?
Right. Two have already been decommissioned, but that was work started by UH, not necessarily by the authority. It completed while the authority was up and running. There's some more policy changes that could affect TMT looming. The UH is planning to allow telescopes to be built on a decommissioned site. At least that's a proposal from the Board of Regents. Now, it could also take many months to figure out because they'll also need to go through more rounds of community hearings. But TMT indicated that they'd like to use one of those decommissioned sites. So that could be a precursor for development.
Yeah, no, it's an intriguing idea. Maybe that would move things faster for construction if need be. But thank you so much, Blaise.
Thanks.
We've been talking to Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Blaise Lebel. You can read his story at civilbeat.org. South Koreans will learn the fate of their former president, Yoon Suk-yeol. Prosecutors have sought the death penalty for the former leader of the country, who declared martial law in late 2024. And with President's Day and Lunar New Year coming back-to-back this week, the president of South Korea, Lee Jae-myung, issued his greetings, his wishes for a society free from injustice and unfairness. This morning, we hear about a recent gathering of academics at the University of Hawaii to talk about democracy in that country. UH professor and former vice chancellor for academic affairs, Carl Kim, was in attendance. We spoke with him this morning.
So this conference was organized by the Center for Korean Studies at the University of Hawaii. The center is led by Professor Young-ah Park, but the person who really organized this conference was Myung-ji Yang, who is a sociology professor. And this conference workshop involved many University of Hawaii faculty and researchers, and then quite a few international and other recognized scholars on Korean democracy joined us. And so we had participation from Canada and Korea, and I think there were many faculty and researchers who came for this conference.
Well, and the whole idea was to look back, right, on 40 years of democracy in South Korea. And it's probably timely given what we saw, you know, gosh, in 2024, right, with martial law being declared and this upheaval.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of personal for me because I've been a professor now for 42 years at the University of Hawaii. And so in 1987, I had a Fulbright to Korea. And that was the time when Korea was under a dictatorship and transitioning. At that time, President Chun Doo-hwan was in power. And there were protests against the authoritarian government. And because of the protests and the demonstrations, which I actually witnessed firsthand, I mean, the first time that I really was exposed to tear gas was that summer in Korea. And so there were widespread protests, which then led to a whole series of democratic reforms, including elections and then more changes in terms of involving public participation in meetings and so forth. And so I've been, I'm a member of the Center for Korean Studies, so some of my research is on Korea, mainly on urban planning. But I've been able to witness the changes, the remarkable changes that have occurred over the past 40 years in this transition from a military dictatorship to democracy.
And I know people's jaws dropped when President Yoon Suk-yeol, declared martial law, right? And we were like, what is going on in South Korea exactly?
Yeah, but it was very short-lived, which on the one hand showed the kind of resilience of the systems that were set up. And then he was subsequently impeached and then found, guilty of insurrection, obstruction of justice, falsifying documents and, violating campaign laws. And so he's currently on trial for mobilizing the military and organizing his supporters to attack the government and the judiciary there. So that that trial is currently underway, and I think the results of that, I think the prosecutors have asked for the death penalty on that version.
You know, I mean, as we mull democracy in South Korea, you know, I think folks are looking at what's happening in our country and just the threads of authoritarianism and wondering, will we be stronger because of this?
Yeah, I think it's very timely and interesting. I mean, you know, on the one hand, there's increased authoritarianism, which is occurring in, across the world. But there's also an increase in populism as well, too. And in part, what's happened in Korea, what's happened in the U.S., is the result of democracy and elections and certain groups getting elected with an agenda that that has been, you know, quite challenging, right?
Well, you know, last week, you know, we saw North Korea's ruler also talk about succession and his, I think, 14-year-old daughter. And so it was just interesting timing when you think about the political landscape in the two Koreas and wondering if there will ever be just one.
Yes, and that is really challenging as well, too, because I think the security threats, the concerns for us in Hawaii, for the region, and for the U.S., I think are really quite significant. And so I think it's really an important opportunity to kind of look at these larger questions about the role of government. And then, again, in Hawaii, you know, PACOM is the oldest and largest and I would argue most important military command. And if you consider not just North Korea, Russia, China, but also the concerns involving Taiwan, Iran, India, Pakistan, I mean, they're very, very significant concerns in the region. So that's why I think it's very important to have these meetings and conferences and workshops like this, because I do think democracy and populism is very much related to the challenges that we have in terms of managing and responding to these threats.
Well, and then what was the takeaway from that conference? I mean, did you come away, you know, feeling better about democracy?
Well, democracy comes in very different varieties. You know, when we think about Korea these days, we think about K-pop or K-drama or beauty or food and Korean culture, which is sort of thriving. And in part, it's because of democracy that a lot of that was allowed to take off. And that's not to say that there aren't contradictions with democracy and the growth of prosperity and wealth and the rising inequities that result from a sudden increase in or these dramatic changes that have occurred. But, you know, one of the takeaways is that there is a Korean version of democracy. And while, you know, democracies share certain characteristics, you know, like elections or the rule of law or a free press or the ability to debate and deliberate important kind of policy decisions for the collective, right? I think there are different versions of it around the world. You know, China touts itself as a democracy. They call their democracy whole process people's democracy, you know, and you know, it's tied to their one-party state. It's tied to a much more hierarchical expert or technocratic view of governance, even though they have opportunities for participation and some involvement of the people. I mean, they actually a couple years ago, China started commissioning these studies on U.S. democracy, and they're kind of fascinating because they kind of critiqued the U.S.'s version of democracy, saying that, you know, it's kind of inefficient and it doesn't lead to the ideal outcomes. So I think these developments need to be studied and evaluated and put into a context. But at the same time, too, I think it's really quite interesting for us in Hawaii, us in the U.S., to really think about the institutions and how we manage them and how we deal with these ongoing problems and challenges, like, you know, trust in government, for example, or the balance of power between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. And I think it applies not just to the U.S., but actually to our state and other subnational entities as well, too. So democracy, so one of the big takeaways, I think, is that Korea has its version of democracy, which is interesting to look at. And all in all, it's been nonviolent, and massive protests have been organized. And I think that there are some important lessons in terms of how to organize and how to involve diverse groups and maybe even people who haven't been well represented in the past in the process as well, too. And so and that's what the conference was about, trying to understand not just democracy as an abstract concept, actually, how does it work on the ground?
Well, I guess, you know, with the way things worked out over there in South Korea, I guess you talk about the resiliency of democracy, right? That martial law was short-lived, and it just forced everybody to re-examine some things of value, going back
That's
to
right.
the core. What do you believe in? I'm going to admit my ignorance, but, you know, where I live, I learned that Syngman Rhee lived on my street, and I was very ignorant at the time about who he was and his connection to Hawaii, and then immersed myself into it, and it's just fascinating. And so, yeah, we constantly need to think about our connection, our past, and our future, right? Because we are all part of this Indo-Pacific region, which is very tenuous right now as far as the political landscape.
Yeah, so I think that there are important lessons for this and connections, especially to Hawaii, as you point out. But the other thing that I was really happy to see was the interesting scholarship and different types of methods and different sources of data and ways of thinking about and understanding democracy and its changes from historical, political, sociological, and cultural perspectives. And so I think it was a very good workshop. And I came away with a sense of hope, actually, because of the research and scholarship and the efforts to try to understand really these complex phenomena, not just theoretically, but actually on the ground. And how does this impact people and communities and those who work directly on important problems?
We've been hearing from University of Hawaii Professor Carl Kim. He took part in a conference at the Center for Korean Studies last week to reflect on 40 years of South Korean democracy. The conference drew academics from across the globe at the UH Manoa campus.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
I think that most of the time, very few Americans are thinking about Cuba. But having said that, if President Trump were to bring down the communist government of Cuba without destroying Cuba along the way, I really think that that would be widely regarded around the world as kind of a historic triumph.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design. Thank you.
As we contemplate Hawaii's role in the Indo-Pacific, a story caught our eye about plans to ramp up arms manufacturing in Hawaii. Honolulu Star advertiser reporter Kevin Nodell joins us to talk about these developments. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so, you know, you attended the Honolulu Defense Forum meeting there in Waikiki last month, and that was something that came up then.
Yeah, and it's something that's kind of been a discussion for a while. And I think one clarification in terms of arms manufacturing here, it's a lot of this is what we're talking about really is kind of replacement parts and the ability to do more maintenance on warships and all kinds of things like that. But definitely something that they've been emphasizing for a while now and seems to be coming closer to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about then what supply chains, right? We're out here in the middle of the Pacific, but what can we do, you know, and help, you know, strengthen this region?
Right. Military leaders out here have this term that they usually use, the tyranny of distance, which is the difficulty of moving their supplies, moving their equipment across the vastness of the Pacific and Indian Oceans, depending on which part of this region we're talking about getting to. And that means that the backlog of getting spare parts, ammunition, and a lot of different critical supplies that they need to operate can take a long time, particularly if you're relying on factories on the mainland or supply chains kind of from overseas. So what they're really kind of hoping to do is to bring more of that manufacturing kind of into the region, as well as the expertise and building up a workforce locally.
Well, you know, last year you and I attended a thing where they rolled out 3D printing in a shipping container, and it was being used on the ships that were out here for, you know, an exercise. And that was fascinating to see. And that, you know, came out of the Ukraine war, right? They were saying you've got all these different, you know, equipment that's being used in that conflict, and you can't exactly wait for a couple of months for a spare part from another country.
Right. The war in Ukraine has really changed a lot of the thinking on how this stuff is actually going to work. What we've kind of seen in the fighting in Ukraine is a lot of manufacturing, like we're kind of talking about, of spare parts and even building small, simple drones, kind of doing it on the front line itself, building and even modifying equipment kind of on the spot. Using a lot of 3D printing, using a lot of tools like that to kind of push things forward so that they don't have to wait, so that supply chains can't be broken, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I recall at the Defense Forum a couple of years ago, Admiral Sam Paparo was saying, you know, we need to really step it up. We're falling behind.
Yep, he did that, and he's been kind of one of the driving forces behind this, along with the Hawaii congressional delegation, to set up more of these training programs and bring some of this technology to the islands. And that message was kind of loud and clear this year, where, if anything, they've been talking about ramping up production kind of across the line and changing the way that the Pentagon does kind of weapons acquisition, equipment acquisition, and kind of rethinking a lot of things about how things have traditionally looked.
Yeah, and there's opportunity for these defense contractors, right, in who are operating in this space to be able to take advantage of the priorities.
Right. You know, historically, a lot of specifically like weapons and equipment contracting in the military has been dominated by what we have known as the primes. You know, your Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, like these very huge companies. But a lot of what they've done has been kind of, you know, they work a lot with each other. They use these very big factories based on the mainland, very centralized. But what they're talking about now is trying to do things a lot faster, kind of more modular operations, you know, generating a lot of stuff, but doing it in more places, smaller volume, but in more locations, and moving it out here where – you know, this is kind of the center of operations in the Pacific, has been a big interest for commanders out here. And it's been an interest by local businesses that are interested in getting in on these defense contracts. That goes back several years, probably.
Yeah.
So it's something that we were talking about here, kind of among those advocates.
Well, it'll be certainly interesting to see how fast they can step this up, but a really interesting story. But thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Kevin Nodell. You can read his story online at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from NAREIT Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NAREITHawaii.com.
3 million documents, but not enough answers. Critics say the last installment from the DOJ's investigation into Jeffrey Epstein is still not enough.
We won't be satisfied until we get the names of Jeffrey Epstein's co-conspirators and the names of the men who were protected.
I'm Amory Sievertson, Accountability in the Epstein Investigation. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
How Water Connects Us All, an exhibition at the University of Hawaii Art Gallery, calls for Vai to run freely here in Hawaii and in the Middle East. Four artists wanted to speak out in solidarity about water's role in self-determination from Lahaina to Lebanon. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with two artists behind the exhibition. Melissa Kamara is a land specialist with the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and Reem Basus is a painter and the executive artistic director of the Washington Studio School in Washington, D.C. Basus starts us off.
I grew up in Beirut during the Civil War, and water rationing was something that I really grew up with, and we didn't have hot water for long periods of time. And so my memory is of us carrying big pots of heated water from the stovetop up to the bathtub, and just so that we could take our bath. And so water scarcity is a big deal. And even to this day, you visit Beirut and you still have to heat water. I mean, there's a switch that you flick on and you have to heat water. So it's not the same as living in the US, for example, where you turn on the hot water faucet and you have hot water. So it makes you take water very seriously from very early on.
And it forces you to be conscious of something that a lot of Americans, I think, probably take for granted. But Melissa, what about your vantage point, your experience with Vi?
It really comes from being a land steward for most of my career since the 1990s and working on environmental protection and forestry and terrestrial conservation. So much of the upland forest, as we all know, many of us here in Hawaii, you know, is responsible for the perennial streams, you know, 270-something perennial streams in Hawaii, 95% of which have been diverted for commercial uses and other things. So it really was that awareness. But in terms of becoming expressive of that awareness, that really came through the artistic practices and installation that I created for the Hawaii Triennial, which it was a falling water installation across invasive deer antlers. And that was really an expression of how integral water is, even in the presence of a totally altered landscape. I think most acutely, though, I became aware of it really through the fires in Lahaina, which I was, you know, intimately involved with on the educational side, and just the lack of water, similar to what Reem is talking about in that landscape.
Reem, thinking about the art that you contributed and in shaping what this exhibition was going to be, did you feel innately that you could just make your art and it would resonate with an audience here in Hawaii? I mean, how did you think about potentially bridging cultures and telling your story and your lived experience in Lebanon?
Well, the two series out of the three in the exhibition, Ceasefire and Scorched Earth, were done specifically for this exhibition. The Living Bones has kind of been an ongoing project, which we included in the exhibition as well. And out of the three series, actually, the Living Bones resonates probably the most with Native Hawaiians because of the iwi and the illustration of iwi. And it's a very personal series to me. And I remember at one point asking Hina and Abby if it would be offensive if the iwi are drawn in these drawings, because it's such a sensitive topic. And they both said, because they are my grandmother's and it's a personal story and it's about Beirut, that they are fully in support of that and they think it makes sense to include them. And I wanted to highlight the devastation of not being able to find your grandmother's remains, in my case, my grandmother's remains, and that's a direct result of war.
Could I ask you to briefly back up for a step and describe the Living Bones to our listeners?
Absolutely. The Living Bones was a series that I started thinking about around, I think, 2019. I was in Beirut and I asked my uncle where my grandmother was buried. And he said, well, she was buried in the Presbyterian Church cemetery, but we don't know where she is anymore. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, there was an aerial bombardment by Israel and they completely demolished the cemetery. And so having lived in Hawaii for 17 years, you know, it's horrifying to understand the unearthing of the bones. I don't know if that's the correct term, but like the exposure of the bones. And on top of that, that there was no intact person anymore. And so the Living Bones is just about me piecing my grandmother together. And I started that series at the end of 2021. And since then, Gaza happened. I lost my father. And it just all, it became an ongoing tribute to the dead.
Melissa, I'm wondering if you could talk about one of your works in the exhibition as well, We Are the Sea.
Yeah, sure. We Are the Sea is really an attempt from my perspective to bring together these two coastal places, Lahaina and then Gaza, and also the Pigeon Rocks of Beirut. I imagine that, you know, they're all at one time, there was no separation, no borders. And it was really to highlight how in the failure and absence of in state support, let's just say, call it that, government support, that the people of these places really and truly know what to do. People came to the aid of those in Lahaina through vessels, and people have come to the aid of those in Gaza through the flotillas that have been ongoing since 2007. I really thought, I was just struck by how remarkable the similarity between those events are, even though, of course, the means is totally different. And I've said this before, the outcome, which is the annihilation of both of those landscapes through human cause, not natural forces, but through human caused settler colonialism, let's just put it at that, is really at the root cause of the devastation there. So it was, and then there's a woman rising in the center of that painting, and she's really the keeper of indigenous knowledge, because it's women in so many of these places that keep going on, that, you know, keep the culture and the food alive. And that's who she represents to me, is that resilience and that knowledge of the land, and that people will always continue to be patient and continue to be resilient and rise up despite all of the horrors that are done to them.
Reem, you shared that this is kind of a wonderful full circle moment for you too, since you used to be affiliated with UH Manoa, and this is getting to see your work now displayed in the main gallery. So what has that felt like, and how do you think about how students and other people affiliated with the university might be interacting with your works?
Well, it's such a great honor. And for me, this moment is so much more than, it's beyond me. This whole moment is beyond me because of the very pressing issue. It's an honor for me to be showing with Melissa and with Hina and with Kahi. It's been very humbling. I've always felt a deep connection and kinship with my Native Hawaiian friends, whom I consider family, because we have similar struggles. And for me, I feel seen when we are showing in a place like Hawaii and we are being received in the way that we have been. It's very comforting. This show of solidarity makes one feel less alone. And that's what this has been largely about. We feel seen and heard. And it's so much more than just the personal reaction to it.
Any final thoughts or anything either of you would like to add?
I'm just so, as Reem, incredibly honored to be a part of this exhibition that is just seen so much support here in Hawaii. I think in many ways, this is the only place this could happen, frankly, given how many people have lost their jobs and livelihoods over speaking out about Palestine and, you know, related topics. So I'm just grateful. I'm so grateful and thankful to the university, especially for supporting us and supporting us, you know, with some criticism, frankly, that's come about as a result, you know, not totally unexpected. So I'm so thrilled that this could happen and that so many people have been engaged in this topic and continue to speak out and continue to work on behalf of people everywhere.
I just want to say thank you to the people of Hawaii, because that solidarity has been everything. And it truly, truly has meant so much. Having our exhibition there is a small part of that solidarity. En masse, Hawaiians have shown up for Palestinians and the Lebanese, and I will forever hold them in my heart, no matter where I go. Thank you.
Those were artists Reem Bassous and Melissa Kimura talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Their exhibition, O Kawai Mai, From Lahaina to the Litany, is on view until tomorrow at the UH Manoa Art Gallery. Look for a gallery tour and walkthrough on Wednesday starting at noon.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Funk and soul group Tower of Power performs songs such as You're Still a Young Man this Thursday and Friday in two sets nightly. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to highlight a small business keeping a long-standing tradition going, making mochi and other sweet treats to celebrate the Lunar New Year. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or reach out on social media. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.